Hey listeners, Eliza and I are heading to Las Vegas to work on a week of episodes exploring the city's exciting food and drink scene. But first, we wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite restaurant or bar, or want to tell us about an underrated gem that we must visit? We'd love to hear about your Las Vegas spots. Write us at hello@tastecooking.com to share. And we look forward to bringing you these special episodes in early June.
So yeah, a lot of people have a lot of guilt about buying food online. And when I say I do it, they're like, oh my God, you do it? I'm like, yeah. And so does the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen. And like, so should you.
You're listening to The Taste Podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief Matt Rodbard, here with Senior Editor Anna Hiesel.
Carla Lolly Music is the food director at Bon Appetit and the author of a great new cookbook, Where Cooking Begins. Also on the show, taste contributor Max Felkowitz answers a burning reader food question. Matt, tell me about Carla's book. Tell me about Where Cooking Begins.
Anna, I love this book for real. I've cooked like 10 things out of it, and it's definitely going to remain on my stack for a very long time.
How is this cookbook going to change the way I actually cook?
And it's going to actually start with the way you shop, because there's an extreme thoughtfulness in the way that Carla lays out the act of shopping. She doesn't have hard rules, but insists that there's fun shopping and necessary shopping, which can also be done online.
The necessary stuff is like my dishwashing soap.
Exactly. Like, go out and, like, go to the butcher, go to the farmer's market, you know, have fun with this act of shopping, but also know that there's, like, not fun shopping involved. And yes, do that in, like, online, like Instacart. We talk about it extensively, how Instacart is changing the way many people are shopping. But then, like, have fun with the times when it's fun. So you're not just doing this one trip where it's, like, half fun, half not fun. You have a car full of groceries. You get home. You unpack them. And you're, like, fuck, I'm so tired. I do not want to cook.
Kind of takes the edge off that.
It does. Like, fun shopping and not fun shopping. Just think of it that way. It's really smart.
Here's Matt talking to Carla.
Carla Music, welcome to the Taste Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I've made about 14 of the recipes from...
You're my MVP, I think. I think you have been the steady, consistent achiever.
Well, honestly, we do a lot of books here at Penguin Random House, Clarkson Potter, 10 Speed Press. We have affiliation with them. And we see a lot of books, but rarely do I find a book that I want to make multiple things from. We'll get into the recipes.
Amazing.
Why do you think I'm such a fan?
That is a great question. I think you've been very enthusiastic. I think, why are you a fan? I think that, you know, cookbooks are weird. People will cook from them and sort of flip around and scattershot. But what I noticed with you is you made one recipe and it was like, well, that was good. Like, that worked out. Let me try another one. And then when you do a few and they're working,
yes,
right, there's a lot in recipe development about like trust and, you know, spending money on ingredients that like it better work. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You better work.
And you've said it so brilliantly. I wanted you to kind of articulate that because they have worked. I mean, the sweet potatoes with tahini butter has worked three times because I've made it three times.
That's awesome.
We will talk about the book, but I wanted to like back up a little bit and talk about your time at Bon App. I like you guys, you and your team in the test kitchen are celebrities now. I'm serious.
I'm enjoying the, I think we're on like minute 13 of 15 and I'm like super happy about that. So enjoying what has happened, the timing between the book and what's been happening with our Bon Appetit on YouTube.
Yeah.
Like I did not see that on the horizon when I was, you know, diligently kind of plugging away at my proposal. Mm-hmm. But the two things coming together has been really incredible. So just having people who like watch us on YouTube, but then like know about the book. And there's been this like great kind of, you know, kinetic energy around that.
Listener, if you haven't checked it out, there's Carla and her team. You've got Brad there. You've got Priya there once in a while. You've got who else?
Claire Saffitz and Molly and Chris and Andy. Yeah.
And Andy. And I have made this comment privately, but never on the podcast. It's like the new Food Network, but it's like the way the Food Network should have operated.
So that's funny because for me as like an OG Food Network person, I worshipped, you know, Sarah Moulton yes. and Two Hot Tamales and those shows where people just cooked, like I thought was so exciting because they were cooking in real time and just sort of sharing this information. And then I think we went into an era, not to knock Food Network, of like the competitions and the things and the stages and the like a lot of fanfare and entertainment around it. I love doing the videos and I love working with the people in the test mm-hmm. kitchen because the guidance that we got or the direction that we got from the beginning was like, guys, just like everybody stop trying to be mm-hmm. some other thing that you think you're supposed to be from watching food shows. Just mm-hmm. like everybody just act normal.
You're like hilarious people, naturally.
I mean, that was, you know, it's you act differently when there's a camera and a sound and they put a mic on you and they're like, okay, Carla, like. Go like start. So it took a really long time just to kind of be normal. And it was our boss, Adam, was like, guys, everybody just like stop acting so weird. Just be normal. And I think, you know, ultimately people will ask me all the time, like, oh, it looks like it's so much fun in the test kitchen, just the way that you and I'm like, it is that much. Yeah. Like we all really like each other. Yeah. You can't put an ensemble like together and be like, let's make a show with like this person, that
you
person.
Pass the chem check.
Yeah, exactly. Chem test, and when we hang out, it's like this is what we talk about anyway, you know? But that I think was the biggest hurdle to get over was like, what should I be like? And then it was like, just don't be like anything. You
Are
know?
You going to expand it out? I mean, you're around 8 to 12 minutes usually. Are you going to expand it out into 30s and 60s?
Yeah, we have a series launching, a new series from the Bon Appetit, which is on our streaming app. So
OTT, baby.
OTT, which I was like, what is it? So they're like, we're doing an OTT thing. I was like, cool, what is it?
I know. Over the top is what it stands for. It's the box that sits on top of your cable box.
Exactly.
That's how we're going to basically watch television in the future.
So if you have Roku or Android or something else or Apple TV and search for Bon Appetit, those are launching there. And the series that I was on is called Making Perfect Pizza. Oh. And we actually, those episodes I think are in the 20 to 30, but I got to go to Italy. So that was pretty, they don't like do that for my average, like how to make a steak video. Yeah. Molly and I actually go to Italy. It was pretty crazy.
Naples or Rome or North?
We were in Campania.
Campania.
Yeah, hanging out with some buffalo.
I want to talk about Where Cooking Begins. It's such an apt title because you do talk a lot about shopping, Where Cooking Begins. And I wanted to kind of quote one of your tenants. Shop in person for the food that excites you. Shop small, shop often. So give me an example of like the often and the small.
Yeah, the things that I want people to shop for in person and to kind of refocus the way you shop for food and use those in-person trips for produce, protein, fish, meat, bread, maybe like a special cheese if you're doing like a cool cheese board. Things that like really matter if you pick them out versus someone else picking them out for you. So fish and meat, like some things are great one day and like not great another. And produce like comes in and out of season and might have been handled really well or might have been like sitting on the shelf for longer. So that's what I really want. I go into a store, stay on the perimeter, right? Mm-hmm. And like focus on your protein and your produce. And if you do that, you need it. It only works if, like, at home, the things that you don't really need to shop for in person are also kind of already there. So in my like quest to walk through a grocery store without even getting a shopping cart, that's like that's like one of my secrets is like I don't pick up the basket because when I do, I just inevitably am like, oh, like beluga lentils. Like, Carla, you don't need beluga lentils. No. Put the beluga lentils down.
Yeah.
Is on the other side of that is I shop online for like all of the things that come in a box, a bag, a jar, or a can. So it's not that I think everybody should cook every single thing from scratch or only eat produce and protein. It's that I want to go home and have my canned tomatoes, my canned beans, my coconut milk, my hot sauces, and my mustard, oil, vinegar, nuts. Like those are there and I don't need to pick them out because a can of Goya beans is a can of Goya beans.
It's always going to be there.
They're all great. You should totally have them, but you don't have to schlep them.
And you talk about openly, you talk about with a lot of like passion about shopping online for groceries, which is something that like I discovered maybe a year and a half ago with Instacart. Yeah. And I feel like it's not talked about enough in food media. But as you say, it's like essential. So how do you shop online?
So, yeah, a lot of people have a lot of guilt about buying food online. And when I say I do it, they're like, oh, my God, you do it? I'm like, yeah. And so does the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen. And like, so should you. How do I shop online? So I really use shopping online for everything I don't want to lug, right? Everything where the quality of that ingredient is constant. Yeah. So, and it's not only pantry in the sense of like, I think pantry, when you say pantry, people think dry goods, right? Beans, salts, and oil. My pantry also includes like citrus, milk, yogurt, butter, you know, things, all of those things you can purchase online. If you know the brand that you like, you're getting convenience. And also with that convenience is time.
And you get the time to then spend in your kitchen and cooking what you want to cook. And I think back to online cooking, shopping, the algorithms are incredible.
Right.
So they will give you the shopping list that they think you will have, and the predictive nature of it is getting better and better.
Yeah. You know, you can even create like your own list, your orders, shop from your last order, pull something up, your favorites. And then, you know, I think there is certainly... there's delivery fees. There's things to take into consideration when you give that advice. And I don't want to kind of gloss over that. But I also think that it has become a buyer's market. There's so much more options. And across the country, there's like Peapod. You can order online and just pick up at a lot of grocers or across the country that are not all in like this New York City urban area.
This isn't an urban thing. This is a suburban thing. And it will soon be probably spreading out more and more to the less urban areas.
And I've found with the online shopping, you have when you have multiple vendors, then you're price comparing.
Yeah.
And it's just gotten easier and easier to get what you want and pay less for it. And make it work for you. Look, if you're in a store and you're picking up the three things that you need and you're like, oh, I also need olive oil, like obviously buy it there. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. But if you can set yourself up, for me, the time that I gained, it also gave me this experience of shopping for food where I didn't have a gigantic list. I didn't have a huge checking out, like being online and bagging all the stuff and then getting home and unpacking all the stuff and then putting it all away to the point where I would get my food away and be like, well, I'm not
cooking. You're exhausted. You're tired.
Yeah, I'm so over it.
Yeah,
like I don't even want to cook anymore. Like I'm like, ugh, where am I going to put this thing? So now I shop for things without a recipe. Uh-huh. I go in, I'm like, well, it looks good. What's sort of like, what am I in the mood for? What do I want to do? And then I get home and I'm like, start just pulling stuff out of the cabinets and the drawers.
Well, I think your book does a really nice job of illustrating how you can kind of spin recipes, and you have this option like A, B, C, D, E, right?
Right.
And that's just the way you've learned to cook at home, right? And adapted.
You mean riffing based on what I have in the house? Yeah, I really do think that is, and I say this in the book, like making substitutions is the mark of a confident cook. Yeah. I think a lot of people who are gaining confidence as a cook think that substituting is a cop out, or that the recipe won't be as good if they make those changes, and get very like wedded to exactly what it says. And I can tell you from experience with developing recipes, like, you know, there are recipes in the book that I had a certain spice, you know, mix in mind. Mm-hmm. And I was working on writing the cookbook.
What's one example?
There was one recipe that actually didn't make it into the book for another reason. But I wanted to do like a pan roasted carrot with turmeric and chili. And I was like, had the whole idea. And I was like, yeah, turmeric, thing, the thing. I'm going to get them brown. I'm going to bloom the spices. I'm going to saucy glossy, whatever. And then I opened the drawer and I was like, don't have turmeric. And I was like, Carly, you idiot. Like, this whole day you've been like conceiving this thing in my head. And it was one of those moments early on when I realized, like, I'm not going to the store to get turmeric right now, because I wouldn't ask a reader to do that either. I would want them to kind of figure out a substitution.
But so, we as home cooks, we freak out.
Yeah.
We freak out. Like, oh my God, I'm
now what I'm done.
Destroy this recipe.
And that's also based on a lot of feedback that I've gotten from recipe, you know, users and readers who are like, I don't have the half teaspoon of smoked paprika. And it's like, don't worry about it. And people are like, what do you mean? It's in the recipe. So I really wanted people to feel like this ingredient is here because it's fulfilling a function, and a lot of other things, ingredients, can fulfill the same function. Like, mm-hmm. It's fine.
It's like Samin's kind of method,
yes,
as well.
That's, I mean, right.
That's kind of the idea.
And when you say that you've made the sweet potatoes with the tahini butter three times, like, that's exciting to me, because I hope that the fourth time you make it, you actually don't have to look at the recipe.
Yeah.
And if you didn't have lime juice to make that butter mixture, but you had unseasoned rice vinegar, you would be like, I'm using that. Like, I thought I had a lime, but I don't. That doesn't mean I can't make this. It just, the lime is there because you need something tangy and sour, because sweet potatoes are like sweet and starchy. Yeah. And, you know, that is like, that excites me when I get feedback from people who are like, Carla, one of my coworkers was like, I made a recipe from the book. Don't get mad at me. I changed a couple things. And I was like, what
Never
did
met.
You do? And she was like, well, it said to use almonds, and in the spin it list, it said I could use, you know, hazelnuts or cashews, but I didn't have that, so I used pistachio. And I was like, if everybody could be like this, you know,
you're going to be,
the recipes are in good hands.
Was that the charred broccoli salad with cheddar, dates, and honey?
No, she was making the pan-roasted Romanesco.
Which I made as well. That's a beautiful. But let's talk about that charred broccoli. So I've made it a few times. Let's walk us through. This is one of my favorite recipes. I really like the sweetness and the saltiness balancing out.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I like about also the method for the broccoli, so you leave it in really big florets, and this is something that goes back to using the whole thing instead of trimming stalks and then not knowing what to do or wasting. I leave like quite a bit of stalk on the broccoli, and then you it's less cutting, first of all. So, like, prepping it doesn't take as long because you don't have to cut it into such
less
small...
mess, because it isn't, like,
yeah,
destroying your cutting board.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I have, like, little bitsy florets flying all over the place. And then you cook those, like, it's almost like skin side down on a fish. Like, you just cook it on the cut side down to get, like, a lot of color and a flavor development. But then you leave it really crunchy. So it's one of these, like, cheap tricks that I love of, like, one ingredient kind of giving you multiple texture payoffs.
Yeah.
And it just comes down to, like, how you treat it. And then there's, is it Gouda?
Oh, you had cheddar as, the,
yeah,
as the number one, but Gouda would be pretty
Gouda
dope.
Would work, I mean, in there. Yeah. So cheddar and the dates and nuts and...
Honey. Which I love.
Right.
Like, honey is something we don't cook with enough on the savory side, I feel. It's more of a baking ingredient.
But honey, like, that's, you know, broccoli is cabbage, so that sweet and bitter flavors, like the way that you would add... I could see putting honey into, like, a dressing that where you're using radicchio, or honey mustard is another good example.
Honey mustard would be good. Yeah.
Yeah. And it must have needed it because I put it in there.
I stand pretty hard for the wheat berries, roasted squash, buttermilk, lemon, and herbs.
Yeah.
Grain bowl. I mean, it's a grain bowl, very, very squirrel.
Yeah.
But, like, why these flavors together? What's
that was one
there?
Of my favorite recipes also. I love... grains. Sometimes I'll just put them on to cook before I figure out the rest of dinner, because it's like, well, worst case scenario, I'll have some already cooked grains.
Yeah,
you know. And that one, that's a very, like, seasonally adaptive recipe, because you've got the squash, so you have the chewy kind of nutty grains. Then the squash are, you know, they get really sweet, and it's a very spoonable texture. So you've got this, like, chewy, creamy, and then a nice punchy dressing that has acidity and spice.
Which I love using. I love using buttermilk. I feel like it's underutilized. My one thing with buttermilk is you buy, like, the big thing of buttermilk. So what do? I like looked at the buttermilk and I actually ended up just throwing it away.
So funny, because you know what's amazing about buttermilk is it does not go bad.
I know. So, I knew that, and I just I look at the date, I just get freaked out. Sorry.
So I have a child who really enjoys pancakes. Oh, yeah. So buttermilk will come up a lot for us that way. But buttermilk also is great to thin out anytime you're like want to thin out yogurt. Like we all buy Greek yogurt now. And if you want to make something that's more dippable, I use buttermilk a lot in dips and dressings.
Yeah.
It's like great that way, but it's also an amazing marinade. Because it has salty, it's sourness, mm-hmm. it's salty.
Pretty much any protein.
It's lactic. Yeah, it's got like those lactic flavors. So then you could just like pour it over. Don't throw out your buttermilk anymore, Matt.
It's crazy. I did it and I thought of you actually when I was I wasn't like mad at you, but I was like, Carla asked me to buy buttermilk and now I'm throwing it away. And I was like, I'm going to ask you about it.
Now you know.
Just like put it on meat.
Yeah, or just use it in a dressing like a vinaigrette where you cut half and half with olive oil and buttermilk would be really, really, really good.
Why dedicate an entire chapter to eggs?
Well, I could have had even more egg recipes. People love, I think we've grown up, right, in the era of put an egg on it, right? So for me,
we're
it was
over
like,
that though, Carla.
I know. So it's like put an egg on it, under it, next to it, with it. And for me, eggs are one of those pantry ingredients that we always have, mm-hmm. but that they're also a great source of protein and like a perfect food. They're really quick cooking. And so they come into play in a lot of meals. They're like a dinner solution, I think.
Yeah.
I love eggs.
What's one of your favorite recipes from that chapter?
I think the No One Talks About It is one of my favorite pictures in the book, too, that carbonara stracciatella, which is like all the flavors in carbonara, but done as kind of an egg drop soup or a stracciatella soup. Yeah. So it's got bacon and it has this like really salty broth, but then... it can't all be sort of richness and parm. So there's lettuces that you put in the bowl and then you just sort of spoon the hot soup over it. And I don't know. I also am like kind of love the idea of lettuce soups and wilting lettuces.
Well, there's multiple textures going on. And I feel like you've articulated this previously. Multiple textures is really key to a great ingredient, a recipe, right?
Yes, definitely. And that one's got... you know, the silky egg, a spoony broth, there's chewy bacon in it. And then you have this wilted kind of lettuce that's giving you freshness, but also gets tender as it sits. I really like that one. And then a lot of black pepper on top. We should make more egg drop soup.
I love it. And lettuce too. Are you working on any lettuce features in the test kitchen?
We're starting to think about spring.
Yeah.
And if we're going to do a spring story that we shoot, we like to, spring and summer like really pays off if you shoot them.
And this is for next year.
And it would run in like spring 2020. Yeah.
I love how that sounds.
Yeah.
Spring 2020. I want to hear a little bit about your previous career in restaurants.
Sure.
You know, you worked as a chef, and I think it clearly shows in your cookbook writing and in your future cookbook writing. You maybe will tackle this more, but do you miss working on the line?
I do a lot of times. Actually, that was not the best paying job I ever had, but it was definitely the purest job I ever had because you would go in. And every day starts over. And, right, you don't carry things from the day before unless you've prepped them or whatever. But every day starts with a new round of service and food that has to be made. It was very immediate. It was high adrenaline. I was never bored. And I just, for a long time, because I worked as a line cook straight out of culinary school, I kind of just couldn't believe that they were paying me to cook. I was like, this is insane. Like, they're not paying me a lot, but they are paying me to cook, which for me was an education.
And you loved the act of cooking and
just
the completion from A to B to C, right?
Totally. I thought the wholeness of it, like someone comes in, they are hungry, they ask for food, you cook it, they eat it, the plate comes back. And I worked in restaurants where the bussers were all trained to show the chef at the line, you know, at the pass, that emptied the plates. So like you would see plates come back empty, plates not coming back empty. And it was like this beautiful little life cycle. And I also really loved, I loved the adrenaline mm-hmm. of it. I loved like the physical nature of that job. I'm sort of like a futzy person. Like I can't sit still for too long. And I realized looking back on it that I loved it because
burn
it was
the energy.
Yeah, it was physical. It was demanding. And I also come from a place or a family where like working hard should involve some amount of suffering. So then I felt like the suffering meant that I was doing something important. You know what I mean? I was like, I'm really putting it all into this.
I mean, that's still the editorial
right.
job too. I mean, there's a lot of suffering in journalism, right?
I feel the same way about massages, actually. Oh, yeah. Like they, if they don't hurt a little bit, like you're yeah. not getting your money's worth.
I wanted to ask you about the restaurant world and do you see yourself ever going back to it? Owning, operating?
Never. No, I really don't. Because I did it as a line cook and it's like a very hard job. And then I did it from the managerial side. So I was a kitchen manager.
Yeah.
Then I was an operations person. And then I was the first general manager at Shake Shack in mm-hmm. Madison Square
That's
Park.
Right.
I really thought that was what I was going to do when I started cooking. I was like, I'm on the path. I'm going to line cook. And then sous chef, executive sous chef, chef, owner, operator. Like that mm-hmm. was really my dream. And the more time I spent in restaurants, I was like, this is a terrible business. I was like, no one should tell the people doing this, but it's like really bad.
The margins are really bad.
The margins are really bad. The margins at Shake Shack were incredible.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I got out of that one too soon. But looking back on it, I can't really imagine it.
Yeah, that's straight talk, because I think people don't talk about the margins in the business, and that's why we should be paying more for our restaurant meals.
That's right.
And supporting restaurants. Like, it's just yet another reminder, yet another example on the Taste Podcast where it's like, restaurants, they're not getting rich.
Right.
People are not getting rich.
I'll say that at the same time, like, the people who do it well, I have the utmost respect for.
Yes.
Like, I love going to restaurants yeah. and supporting that industry. And I just can't imagine making it work, you know? Yeah.
What was your break then to get into journalism? I mean, there must be a moment, like an inflection point where you
yeah.
went from GM to journalist.
Yeah. So I was, after Shake Shack, I was teaching culinary management and I was consulting. I'd kind of been like, it was a really intense time. And I was expecting my second child. And I was teaching culinary management at Institute for Culinary Education. And a friend of mine had a friend who became the deputy editor at Everyday Food magazine. And that friend came to me and she was like, oh, you know, my friend's hiring. And she's met a lot of magazine people, but she's like just meeting a lot of people. Would you ever want to go interview? And I was like, sure. Like, at the very least, I'm going to have a good story yeah. for my students, a lot of whom were in culinary management, but they were really interested in food media, and I didn't have a ton to report on that to them. So I was like, well,
you're going as a spy.
Exactly. I was like, at the very least, I'm going to go through like HR at Martha Stewart. Like, that's going to be a trip, and I'll, you know, of course. So I started interviewing, and I would like have an interview with her, and then 3 weeks later, I wouldn't hear anything. She'd be like, oh, come back. I want to have another, like, let's meet again. So it was like getting dragged out and dragged. And then at the end of this like very long interviewing process, she offered me the job of deputy editor, which was pretty incredible considering I had worked in book publishing straight out of college before I started cooking. So there was like a little, you know, and then I had the food experience. So it was like this first time that I was able to link the two.
That was good for like probably the sign off and the upper. Like, she has a little bit of editorial.
Exactly.
She's not just a cook. Good.
And I think
good.
I got that job because she was surrounded by a lot of magazine and editorial people. And I was bringing like some other kind of information about, you know, hands on experience about cooking and recipe developing. And, you know, then I was like, well, writing a menu is not that different from writing a headline. So, and it was really that job that introed me into Bon Appetit. So I, you know, again, like couldn't have replicated the course of my career, but the fact that I can draw on the restaurant experience and the repetition of the way that I learned how to cook was through rote. You know what I mean? You get so much experience in such a short amount of time when you're searing scallops every day for 6 hours for 5 days a week.
Which can be applied to journalism,
yeah,
of course.
Exactly.
Like you're doing front of book, it's January, then it's February, then it's March, then it's April. And you go over and over and over again. And I feel like I'm glad to hear this story. I hope it inspires listeners who maybe aren't in the traditional journalism world.
Yeah.
Journalism school, just saying, didn't do it myself. Not really a huge fan. Another day.
I say that about cooking school too. Like if you end up in a good restaurant where they're willing to invest to train you, but where you need to learn good, like choose your restaurants wisely. Like you want to go somewhere where you're going to learn good habits, because you can go to work in a restaurant and learn some really crappy habits as a chef. I learned more. I mean, it was great foundation, but I learned more working.
Completely.
That's why I couldn't believe they were paying me.
Carla, I wanted to ask you, we ask all of our guests on the Taste Podcast, there was a book project out there. I know your book just came out, so we're not, you probably don't want to think about making another book. But when you want to make another book, when that time comes, what is the dream project for you?
Wow, that's a very tough question. It's more like, is there dream technology that would make it so that writing would be faster?
Yeah.
The writing was the hardest. I almost had a dream project with this one because I worked with everyone who I wanted to work with, including my sister, who was the prop stylist.
Oh, cool.
Like being able to collaborate with people that I respected so much in my field from working in magazines. I had relationships with people. So when I put that team together, I was like, "This, I can't believe this is going down like this." Mm-hmm. My dream, I do have a dream of really pushing the way that recipes are written further. I think that I was very focused on having a conversational tone in the writing, not only of like the written parts of the book, but in the recipes as well. So that, you know, sometimes recipes are written in this very technical language. And when you read a lot of recipes, it gets really boring.
It's rubric.
Yeah, exactly. It's like text, you know, scientific text or this like other kind. And so the dream for the next book, and I definitely want to write another one, would be to somehow continue to like push that so that the recipes would be even more kind of breaking down what you're supposed to, how you're, you know, just forget about a style guide, just like being able to explain things in a way that people really understand and can visualize.
I think Where Cooking Begins does that in a way. I feel like the recipes are not larded with like words that are unnecessary. They're really intuitive.
I tried to be really visually like attentive of what was happening visually in a pan while I was cooking, because a lot of it was recipes that I did know very instinctively because they're things I cook all the time. And really, you have to record, you know, your weights and your measures and your volumes and timing. And so that was like, you know, I always had a notepad out. But I really tried when I was cooking to like pay attention. What is the difference between like a dry sizzle sound and like a nice, juicy, enough oil, wet sizzling sound? And to train yourself to listen for that so that you know without necessarily, you're just taking in a lot more information, getting a lot more feedback from what's happening in the pot, you know? That was a big thing for me, just because like we go off of times and like you can't go off of
Never.
Times. Yeah.
Electric flame and a gas flame. Come on.
Or like thin pan, really heavy bottom
pan.
You know?
That's something we don't talk about enough, is like pans actually have
thickness. Big time.
Like one costs $5 and one costs $75.
That really hit home. I was at an Airbnb a couple years ago reporting a story. So I was staying in an Airbnb, and one morning I got up and I was like, I'm going to poach an egg before I go to the shoot. And the place was lovely. They had great taste, but they had the crappiest kitchen stuff. And I had a pan. I know how to poach an egg, okay? Yeah. I like took this pan. I was coated with this weird thing and had grooves on the bottom. And it was like this giant plastic-coated spoon. And I literally was like, I don't even know what's happening, but I have a pan of simmering water and somehow the egg is stuck to the bottom of the pan.
Oh, it just like went boom to the bottom.
And it just made me realize like that cooking is so much harder when you can't rely on the quality of the equipment.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a big, it changes everything. I was like, I don't know what's happening. I'm pretty sure I'm doing it the way I always do. And like, I just stuck a poached egg to the bottom of the pan.
Yeah, listener, take that away. It's like good advice. Like, maybe spend a little bit extra on that pan. Or if it's not working, it might not be your fault. It might be your equipment's fault.
Exactly.
Carla Music, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're joined by Max Falkowitz, producer of the Taste Food Questions, which appears on the Taste Daily podcast feed. Listener, you should definitely subscribe to Taste Daily. Max, I have a question for you. Do spices really expire?
So the thing that makes spices taste good and makes them taste like spices is this collection of aromatic oils and other compounds that are exuded by oil sacs whenever you break open and apply heat to the seed, bark, or whatever you're cooking. And those oils degrade over time. And every time that you smell them, that's because they're leaving the food and going away. So do spices ever expire? Not really, in the sense that they won't go bad. They won't rot. They won't get moldy. They won't make you sick, but they definitely lose potency over time. And the general wisdom that most spice industry professionals would recommend is that depending on how fresh the original source of spices that you're getting, keep ground spices for around 6 months, keep whole spices for a year, maybe two. The real problem is that most supermarket spices arrive at the supermarket already stale, because the commodities market for spices involves a lot of waiting around, and you're not. So if you're buying spices from a supermarket, use them, I would say, as soon as possible, and buy whole spices and grind them yourself.
And so buying whole spices, are we talking, like, what are some spices that you should definitely really think about buying whole?
So I always buy cumin seeds whole, and I don't even bother to grind them, because whole cumin seeds work great on their own. I really like grinding my own cinnamon when I can, and I'll usually throw a couple sticks in a coffee grinder and keep that around for a month or two for like really fresh ground cinnamon. It'll completely change your perception of what cinnamon should taste like.
And you're kind of in the spice trade business yourself. You work at a company called Snook, and you do some consulting. Talk about that a little bit.
So Snook is an online grocery devoted to hard-to-find specialty ingredients from around the world, and it carries foods from like 2,000 foods, from spices to grains to strange vinegars to preserves. And one of the things that we specialize in is spices. We have, I think, over 400 at last count, and we're carrying some exclusive imports from Myanmar and Lebanon. And it's a wonderful market that everyone should check out. It's snookfoods.com. And we also do a lot of stories on the foods that we carry. So
love it. And definitely, listener, check out the website, because there's a lot of great journalism happening there. Max, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Taste Podcast is hosted by Matt Rodbard and me, Anna Heasel. The show is produced by Gabrielle Lewis, studio recordings by Pat Stango, theme music by Steve Rydell. Interviews are recorded live at Books Are Magic in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, and at Penguin Random House Studios in Manhattan. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com. Thanks for listening.